Matthew Dawkins, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Dixie Cochran.
Hello.
And Eddie Webb.
Hello.
And today, for the very first time, genuinely, we've not tried recording this one already. We are going to be...
I think we can be transparent about that if we need to. we lost an episode.
Good. To be fair, I was ranting about it on just about every social media network, so I think people know where this
you
podcast
were. Yeah,
I
know.
We definitely lost an episode, so we're going to do a better one in its place, because that's how we roll.
But you know...
And for people who are hearing about the Windows 10 bug where files disappearing, it's totally true.
You know, but that's the thing. If we now have a lost episode, so that's a mysterious thing. It means if the files ever just show up miraculously because Windows, someone has them somewhere, we'll be able to upload it as a special, and it will sound almost identical to this one.
The Windows oubliette just regurgitates a file randomly.
But so those of you who don't know what this episode is going to be about, because you haven't heard the last episode, the subject is the benefits one can draw from role-playing games. Whether they be social, based on confidence, whether they're based on education, or simply the fun you are hoping to derive from playing a role-playing game. We're going to talk a little about our personal experiences, as well as some of the foundations that have been set up to really use role-playing games as either educational or social assistance tools. So it's going to be a little bit of a deep dive into that part of the world, which Eddie and Dixie and I, we all share, I guess, stories, as we know, as we already know, because we've already discussed them. But... We all share stories of growing up either lacking confidence or suffering a bit of bullying or something of that ilk, and have each found that role-playing games have helped us in our own ways. And I suppose that's probably a good place as any to start. So, Dixie, tell us your story.
Okay, well... I tell this to people all the time. Like, I was an awkward child. I was, you know, I was super popular because I had an eye patch, because I had a lazy eye when I was a kid. And I had big buck teeth and giant granny glasses. And I could read by the age of 3, so I was a weird kid coming into kindergarten. And I was always, like, trying to make friends, not really understanding, you know, how kids judge people, etc. I continue to be awkward. I'm still kind of awkward, actually.
Aren't we all?
Yeah. It's okay now, because now, like, nerd is a cool thing to be. So,
right.
Yeah. I'm kind of glad that happened. But, yeah, so I was just kind of a strange kid. And when I got into high school, so when I was 14, I discovered the Sci-Fi Fantasy Club there, started playing Vampire and Innomine and Changeling and all kinds of other role-playing games with everybody. And those really became my people. And, like, the Sci-Fi Fantasy Club at my high school was a really interesting, like, mishmash of a bunch of different kids. Like, a lot of the goth and punk kids hung out there, and then also a lot of just kind of the, you know, band geek types, theater kids, whatever. Like, it was really cool, like, cross-section of high school culture. But it was almost always the outcast groups on some level. And we all kind of found each other and became accepted. And it was the one place where I felt actually cool, you know, dressing like I did. And then, because for those who don't know me, like, still a goth. Like, 33 years old, still wear black all the time, still have green hair.
It's goth professional now, as opposed to goth casual.
You know, you say that, but I'm usually just in, like, a shredded 80s band t-shirt and ripped jeans, so I think I still dress like I did when I was 17, or like a 17-year-old would in 1987, when I was not 17, when I was 2. It's really weird. But
you go backwards in time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, honestly, and that's something that I've talked about before, I blame things like Vampire the Masquerade for a lot of that, like looking at, you know, Tim Bradstreet's art and stuff, and I was like, I could look like that. Like,
yeah.
I could do that. I could cut up a t-shirt and wear a leather jacket and be cool. And yeah, that was one of the first times that I felt, like I said, super accepted. I felt cool. Like, until high school, going through, like, middle and elementary school, I never had more than 2 or 3 friends at any given time. Like, I always had 2 or 3 other, you know, kids, usually girls, who were also weird. You know, in middle school, we spent most of our time writing X-Men and Sailor Moon fan fiction. Before the internet was even the really big repository for fan fiction that it was now. And collecting Beanie Babies, because I was super cool. Yeah, yeah. So yeah, no, the other thing that role-playing gave me as a kid is that, you know, I grew up having very poor self-esteem. Because of all the other aforementioned reasons. And because I got made fun of all the time. I got bullied a lot. I actually almost left middle school due to bullying. Like, I almost transferred middle schools in seventh grade because it was so bad. And when I got into high school and started doing the role-playing games, like, playing somebody else, like playing a super cool, sexy vampire, for instance, made me feel a little bit better all the time. Because I was like, yeah, like, my character's super cool and sexy and wears all black and does cool things and listens to the same music I do, because obviously usually your first characters are kind of modeled on you, like the ideal version of you. Right. So of course one of my first characters that I played for years was this super sexy vampire chick who ran a goth club and dressed the way I would dress if I had lots of money. And yeah, so that really, like, playing her and embodying her kind of leaked over into, I think, my real life. And I got a lot more just kind of, I don't curse in this podcast very often, but I got a lot more like, fuck you with my attitude to people because of getting to play her and also reading literature where there were badass female characters and things like that. So, yeah, that's my background in a nutshell. Eddie, do you have stories?
Actually, mine is pretty similar to yours in a lot of ways. When I was growing up, I didn't really connect with people. I was the weird kid. In Northern Ohio, during the mid-80s, the city I was in was trying a pilot program for magnet schools.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up going to the gifted school across town once I got to high school. And so I got not only the bullying and harassment from people who thought that I must be think I'm better than them because they're not in the pilot program, and also the people in the pilot program who thought that I was not as smart as they were. So that was a fun little intersection of chaos.
Yeah.
And on top of that, because I had hearing loss as a very young kid, I was actually put for a while into deaf class because they thought that there was a very real chance I would lose my hearing entirely, and so I should probably learn sign language pretty quickly. And so also I was not deaf enough for the deaf kids. So it was loads of fun. But I did kind of find my intersection with the video club, video production club.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of us were comic book fans. So I mentioned before on the podcast that while I owned Dungeons & Dragons, the first game I actually played regularly was Marvel Superheroes, because it was something that we could all kind of commonly talk about and agree on. And it was, you know, a pretty big game. It was actually being sold in toy stores and the like. So, I mean, it was not a obscure little game. It was actually really well known. So we played a lot of that, and that really helped me to get through it on the one side because, you know, being a hero, it's like, well, certain things you just shouldn't do when you're a hero. And so that helped me to kind of tamp my anger down to a certain degree. But then I found Vampire the Masquerade, which basically did the opposite.
Right, yeah, let's like embrace it a little bit, you know?
Right, yeah, because it was the, you know what, I'm tired of being the good guy and trying to turn the other cheek. And so Vampire Masquerade came out, the Brujah were very attractive to me. I was also sliding into, while you were very, you know, kind of trying to find yourself in the goth scene, I was finding myself in the punk scene, but there's not a strong punk scene in Midwestern Ohio. So a lot of my perspective of that scene came from things like Vampire the Masquerade. Like, that's the first place I ever saw the Anarchy symbol, was the Brujah logo upside down. It's like, oh, that's cool. And actually to this day, seeing the Anarchy symbol right side up still looks weird to me. So it helped me to kind of find those two poles, the being a good person and righteous anger, and I was able to, like you said, Dixie, I was able to kind of experiment and find my idealized self in both of those perspectives. You know, in the Marvel Superheroes game, I was able to kind of, okay, what if I had all these cool abilities and I wasn't feeling weak and disabled and frustrated with the world? What if I was actually a stronger, better person? And then with Vampire, it was kind of, and what if none of that mattered? What if I could just scream at someone and vent my frustrations and have something result from that?
Right.
And so it allowed me to kind of really find my path in terms of, okay, sometimes screaming at someone's not the best option, but it does feel really good. And exploring that in a safe environment allowed me, okay, so now I have a better sense of when it's okay to be angry, when it's okay to not.
You know, it's really interesting, some of the parallels that I think a lot of, you know, some of the kind of, like, I always refer to them collectively as the weird kids. Mm-hmm. If that's offensive to anybody, I apologize, but that's just kind of my collective word for the punks, the goths, the kind of hippie kids, the band kid, you know, whatever, like all the ones that weren't the popular kids. Yeah. One of the interesting parallels between me and you, though, is that feeling of not being something enough. Yeah. It's like, I did theater, but I wasn't trying to make it my profession, so I wasn't one of those super, super theater kids. And I wasn't as good as a lot of them, to be perfectly frank. Like, I wasn't as good of a singer or dancer as a lot of them. And so I wasn't enough of a theater kid to identify that way. And then I was this goth kid, but a lot of the other goth kids at my high school, at least, there was a big drug culture and a lot of skipping class and a lot of doing this, and I didn't do drugs, and I actually did okay in school and, you know, wanted to study and read books and stuff, so I wasn't, like, wild enough for them. And then, yeah, there were a lot of these weird little parallels where it's like, oh, you're this thing, but you're not enough of this thing, so go do this thing instead, you know? And figuring out where you belong with that is really hard.
Yeah, when you just mentioned the goth kids and their relationship with drugs in school, for me that was hip-hop culture. A lot, the school I went to had a very strong black and Latino population, and so there was a lot of that. And so I had this weird kind of blend of, I listened to punk and that made me weird, but also I started to slowly gravitate to hip-hop because, you know, that's how I actually made some friends a little bit as I got a little more confident through role-playing games, is to be able to say, oh, we're angry about the same things. But then, like, you know, it wasn't cool, it wasn't okay until Anthrax did a song with Public Enemy, and it's just like, oh, okay, well, they can hang together, so maybe we can hang together. But that was, like, pretty far in that point. But I started to find out that it was okay to kind of explore these boundaries, but still, same thing. It's like, they're like, oh, cool, you're cool, so you can hang out with us and sell guns to gangsters. And it's like, okay, maybe not so much that. Go back to studying.
Right. So, Matthew, what's your background?
Well, I've not been interrupting, you see, because I've been finding this quite fascinating. It's interesting to hear your stories and what you've been through, because I had a similar past, I guess, that led to my getting into role-playing and role-playing significantly changing my life. I went through a long period of being bullied at school, mainly due to my voice being being particularly slow, ponderous, or depending on the bully you asked, it was either too deep, too slow, too nasal, too posh, too rural. Honestly, I got called all of those things.
Oh my god!
Genuinely, there would be one bully at school who would... It's horrible that you can remember these things. They're, you know, they are seared onto your mind. But I can remember one coming up to me and saying, say aloud, "My name is Matthew Dawkins." And another one saying, "Say, my name is Matthew Dawkins," and things like that. And it doesn't sound like much. You know, that sounds like nothing at all, maybe, to some people. But when you're constantly being told to demonstrate your voice because it's a subject of humor and mockery to a group at school, it can quickly get you down, make you not a terribly confident child. And this went all the way through from my primary school years to my secondary school years, up until I was about 18. And my confidence had been so crushed by the time I was that age, it wasn't like I was going to suddenly start fighting back in my late teens. I had already become convinced that I wasn't going to have a career where speaking was my profession.
I want to interrupt you slightly, because I think American listeners could probably use a little more context here. If I'm correct, Matthew, accent's a pretty big indicator of class and kind of perspective in England. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, it is. And I don't know whether it was the accent in particular. I mean, I come from a very rural county anyway.
Okay.
And I think the people liked to think, and it was a strange, it was a label I was never really given, but I was treated as if I was, in inverted commas, slow. Because I spoke... Mm-hmm. slowly, and because I thought about everything I was going to say before I said it, to a compulsive degree, I would say. You know, it's only in retrospect I can look back at how I behaved and think, I was so afraid of being embarrassed by saying the wrong thing that I would think about what I was saying, usually just as I was starting to speak. So I had this long sort of wind-up, a drawl. And by the time I was 18, yeah, I was not a confident person. I was definitely far from the sort of person who'd feel confident enough to go up to a girl and ask her out or anything like that, because, God, I could hardly speak to my friends without feeling shy. And then I got into role-playing. I know this sounds like some commercial. then I found tabletop gaming. But... it was like one of those sort of regression hypnotism things where I found myself, as soon as I could adopt a character, or more often, as soon as I could act as a GM, I could find myself speaking with a great deal more confidence. I was someone else. I wasn't me. And I was able to speak quickly. I was able to put on my own accents. I could do voices, and I can do quite a lot of voices. I don't often sort of crack them out for this podcast, other than the awful, odd, occasional wrestling impression. But I can... I'm a fairly vocally flexible person, as it turns out. And it only really became apparent when I started role-playing, when I started doing my videos on YouTube about role-playing games. And those in particular, when you have to, as I did, record the same video over and over again, because I can't stand edits in videos. I hate jumping around. I know that's very much the trend of the time, especially with YouTube, that sort of quick edit, but I like one continuous shot. That's just my preference. So if I got 14 minutes into a 15 minute video and I flubbed, I would just say fuck it, and I would stop and I would start again. And it's like an actor, I guess, rehearsing to a mirror. You eventually get your lines down pat. You're speaking with so much confidence because you know exactly what you're going to say, that eventually it translated into being able to do it organically. So when I took on a career as a trainer, a technical trainer in an office, for various office companies, I had to stand up in front of a classroom and talk to people I didn't know about a subject about which I knew little. I would run role-playing games. I would often improvise role-playing games. I often do that more now than I plan them. And in the past, I would heavily script my RPGs when I was GMing because I wanted to know exactly what I was going to say. Now, I just... it's all off the cuff. And all of this is down, for me, to RPGs. I'm not overemphasizing when I say that without tabletop RPGs, I can't imagine the kind of social introvert I would be now. And I think most people who interact with me now, whether at conventions, at role-playing clubs, wherever, or just in day-to-day life, wouldn't look at me and say, well, he's a shying wallflower. They would think, well, he's the one who keeps interrupting people on the podcast. Or he's the one who loves the sound of his own voice. So that's the thing that I inwardly laugh at if someone ever says to me that you love the sound of my own voice, because I still don't. But because I speak fairly eloquently, I guess, I always put my words in the right order. I lilt when I want to put emphasis on things rather than just shouting. It's all very self-trained. And that's all come through GMing games, playing games. And so, yeah, RPGs have had a huge impact on me.
Yeah, I mean, and I think... again, there's a connection, I think, between your story and mine in the sense that you basically self-taught yourself speech therapy, really.
I did, and too. Guess what? I had a stutter growing up, like a really bad one.
That's right. Yeah, you mentioned that.
Yeah, it still pops out sometimes. I'm sure anybody that's heard the podcast has heard me do it a little bit, but usually it's just one or two repetitions now, as opposed to it being... I can't talk for 30 seconds, which is what it was when I was a kid. Because when I was a kid, I could tell when I was about to stutter. And so I would end up doing kind of what you were talking about, Matthew, where I would just draw out a sound. Because I could tell that if I kept talking, a stutter was going to happen, and I didn't want that, because let me tell you, the kids that did the Porky Pig voice at me all the time were real great. So that actually affected me a lot. I took Japanese for many years, and one of the sounds that makes me stutter the worst is the ah syllable, if that starts a word. And unfortunately, the way that you say you in Japanese is anata. So when I would have to stand up in Japanese class and do dialogues, there were times when I would stand there for what felt like 10 years going, just couldn't spit it out. So I think I think role-playing helped. I think acting helped too, obviously. Like theater is very, very helpful, because having to memorize lines as opposed to just trying to talk off the cuff. I did a lot of Shakespeare, things like that, which definitely helped. But yeah, no. I find it interesting that all of us had some kind of speech hearing something thing going on.
Well, yeah, because I also had speech therapy classes, because I spoke even faster than I do now, like almost incomprehensibly so. The one I was always joked about was the Micro Machines commercial was very popular.
I remember this.
Yeah, or Wreck-Gar, from Transformers, same actor. And Savage's shtick was that he would speak very, very quickly. Because all of us to some level had to think about what we're talking about. And it's interesting you mentioned a stutter, because I know I actually do a little more of that than you do now on the podcast, because I occasionally have that same thing where my brain's going too fast and so I'm tripping over my words. But because we all think about how we use our voice, RPGs, that's all you really have on some level, is you're communicating the entire experience through your voice. So because we think about it, and then in RPGs we're forced to constantly use, because you can't not talk during a tabletop RPG, really. It's very, very difficult to do it without talking. And so that really kind of puts you through the ringer in terms of using your voice in a wide variety of ways, but in a relatively safe space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, especially for me playing vampires, like, I don't talk like this usually when I'm playing a vampire character. I'm usually a lot lower and a lot more measured and a lot more elegant sounding, because that's my preference for vampires. I don't know. That's what they sound like.
That's interesting. I've never really analyzed my default vampire voice, but it's usually more like this. Yeah, I can already...
Mine's louder. Mine's just louder.
It's funny, actually, saying, Dixie, that you look to Shakespeare quite a lot for I guess, your speech therapy, your self-speech therapy, because, obviously, the way Shakespeare is written is a fantastic vocal coach.
Yep, we did a lot of Scansion in high school theater.
I know not everyone loves him, some people hate him, but I used to love listening to Christopher Hitchens. And now departed, of course, but he was a fantastic polemicist, brilliant speaker, and it was through listening to Christopher Hitchens that taught me to never finish a sentence with a preposition. If I even come anywhere close to finishing a sentence in a way that is unsatisfactory to me now, I will end it with some kind of proclamation and exclamation. Christopher Hitchens will always say "sir" at the end of a line if there's nothing else to put at the end of a line, because he hated prepositions, and it's just something I kind of absorbed into my own vocabulary.
It's a slight digression, but if you've ever watched Trevor Noah's stand-up show on Netflix, one of the funniest bits he has is where Nelson Mandela meets Barack Obama, and it's like 5 minutes of basically Nelson Mandela giving a voice coach to Barack Obama, and of course Trevor's doing both of the voices, and I think I found that particularly funny, because it was just really digging in deep into how you use your voice and the effectiveness and what pitch and speed and timbre and husk all do to change the impact of it. And so he's going from this super high squeaky Chicago kid down to the voice we recognize as Obama's voice. So it's one of those things that I found, I think, way more funny than my family did because of these things.
Yeah, I find people that can bounce back and forth between voices very easily fascinating, because I tend to have trouble doing a lot of them, and I tend to have trouble remembering what I've done before, like when I'm GMing. I was running Monarchies of Mal for my roommates a while back, the adventure from the core book, and I did
Rat King.
Right, but I also there's three characters in there who are all, you know, mice and rats and stuff that are all important, and I was doing a different voice for all three of them, but I kept forgetting which one was which voice. And I would come back and be like, wait a minute, was this the mouse that talked like this? Yes, okay. And then it's just like, I don't know what I'm doing right now. Because, yeah, it was fun, but I have trouble keeping track if I'm doing, like, eight voices for NPCs. Because, yeah, they'll start to bleed into each other. But if I'm just playing a character, once I get their inflection down, usually over the course of the first session or so, then I can generally slip into that for the entire time I'm playing.
This is a bit of a digression, but I read a fascinating interview
this,
with
this episode
Nicholas
is
Briggs.
All digressions,
he's
and I'm
the
kind
voice
of
actor
it.
Who does. Yeah, it's fine. But he does all the voices for the Daleks on the Doctor Who show
right
now. And he says there's basically three Dalek voices. And he's like, there's high, middle, and low. And he says, what that you do is actually draw arrows on the script as to which Dalek should have the high voice, which one should have the low voice, and which one should have the normal voice.
Oh.
And I'm like, that's a super cool GM trick, is like for NPCs. It's like, okay, this is mouse, this is high mouse, this is low mouse, this is medium mouse, or whatever.
Right.
I just put a note by the character name, like a little icon. Yeah.
Yeah.
I would always, when I was running Werewolf the Apocalypse, we'll get onto another subject in a minute, but when I was running Werewolf the Apocalypse for a long chronicle, the pack took Raven as their pack totem. And whenever they would pass through to the Umbra and they would actually meet a visual manifestation of their totem, I always gave him Christopher Walken's voice. And in any other game, it would seem utterly ridiculous for a character to have Christopher Walken's voice, unless it's Christopher Walken. But for some reason, the idea of the Raven totem sounding, you know, he's going quite high and low, you know, he's very...
Yeah, it actually works.
Yeah, it really grabbed them. They loved it, and not one person laughed during the entire thing. They just took it as it was. But anyway, something I think is worth speaking about. There's a couple of foundations that use role-playing games to assist people who have had difficulties in their life. And Eddie, I know you're the expert on this subject. iThrive being one of them, but perhaps you could tell us a little about that.
Absolutely. One of the things we announced at Gen Con actually was that we're doing a partnership with iThrive and another group called the Bahana Group, which I'll get to in a second. But iThrive, they are a group of scientists and educators and therapists who are actually trying to pull together resources to help. Initially, it was video game designers to create games that are more empathic for teenage kids, and also using teenage kids to understand how to use video games to explore topics that are important to them. So it's things like, you know, how do we do better with mental health concerns, and how do we pitch them better to teens, and what kinds of things are getting out of them, and then there's of course the added benefit to the video game industry of how they can create games that are better geared towards attraction in that market, because it's a very strong volatile market that adults often have difficulty writing for or designing into. And the creative director, Heidi McDonald, she's been a friend of mine for a few years. We've known each other through the video game industry. And she tells a story about how her son, Ian, basically one day said, why can't there be a game like D&D, but instead of attributes like strength, intelligence, and wisdom, it's stats like empathy and understanding and encouragement. And so they got them working on what they're now calling the Critical Strengths Engine, which the idea is that this is a tabletop game that people can use as just a fun, light tabletop system, but also during the course of the game, you are learning skills to help you with social connectivity, empathy, mental strength, how to address concerns in your life, and so on and so forth. So it provides therapeutic value based on actual science without being pitched as a therapeutic game. It doesn't feel like education. And so they asked me to not only consult for that, because I was the only person in the group who really understood tabletop role-playing game design, But separately, also, they asked me to write an adventure for them based in the world of Pugmire, because they felt that the Pugmire world was a really good fit with its be a good dog edicts and its implicit and explicit emphasis on cooperation and working together.
Right.
And I realized some of that connection because of the other group. There's a group called the Badhana Group, which actually Rich Thomas is a board member of. I'm actually going to a convention by the time this episode lands. I'll be there, Save Against Fear, with the Badhana Group. And what they are is a group of therapists who use tabletop role-playing games in their actual sessions. So whereas I Thrive is the study and analysis and the research side of it, Bahana is the application side of it. And they had not heard of each other, actually. I was the person who made the introduction between both groups, and they're like, oh my God, how have we not met each other, you know? Jack Bergenstock, the head of that group, says he's had a lot of good value in using Pugmire specifically as a therapeutic tool in his groups. And then although he also has adults in his groups, particularly working with kids, he said he's been very, very useful for him. And so at this convention, it's really interesting because it is a gaming convention primarily. And I'm going there to run Pugmire and, you know, sit on panels. But also there are sessions like a bunch of therapists coming in to talk and learn how better to use tabletop role-playing games in their sessions, and what kind of benefits and ways that you can tweak the games out of the box to be more effective. And he's consulting as well on this RPG. And so all of this kind of came to an interesting intersection a few weeks ago. iThrive actually asked me to come out to a design hive to consult for them, but also they want some brainstorming, and they have invited a bunch of other luminaries from the video game industry. And so I learned a ton about the science behind a therapeutic use of tabletop role-playing games. And so that's one thing I love digging into personally. I think it's a fascinating subject, but one thing I do want to kind of qualify all of that with is that while tabletop role-playing games outside of a structured environment may have inadvertent therapeutic value, they are not themselves therapy. And I've seen a lot of people kind of confuse those. I was confusing them for a long time. It's like, oh, I played Vampire the Masquerade and, you know, that helped me to come out of my shell and helped me to parse my anger. And that's cool. And that definitely is explicit therapeutic value, but that was not a substitute for therapy to kind of resolve those issues. I still went to a speech therapy class to handle some of my therapeutic issues. I went to other specialists to struggle through my problems with disability. It's just role-playing games allowed me to explore some of those skills and use them in a much more in a safer environment. So I didn't necessarily... My point is that you can't use tabletop role-playing games as a replacement for therapy, but certainly a lot of people get value out of them, and like we talked about.
Yeah.
So it's a fascinating, fascinating concept.
Yeah, I've been pretty open about like struggling with anxiety and depression for my entire life, honestly. But I didn't go to therapy for that in high school just because it wasn't diagnosed. It wasn't as common as it is now to be diagnosed. So even though role playing games helped me, I should have been in therapy since I was probably about 10 years old. And probably would have been better faster because of it. Because I didn't start going to therapy regularly until I was in my 20s. And now I'm 33 and I go super intermittently, like every now and then. I'm like, man, I've been having a rough like month. I should go see my therapist. But yeah, like that's something that I should have done along with it. I'm really glad I found role-playing games, and I'm glad that I found the goth community and everything, because honestly, I'm not sure what would have happened to me had I not. So yeah, it had therapeutic value, but yeah, you're absolutely correct. It's no replacement for if you are a person who does need therapy, then you should probably go to therapy if you can.
Oh, certainly. I think there's definitely a catharsis through role-playing, whether it's through the means of escapism by getting to play someone that you're not, especially if you're coming from a particularly hellish household situation. As an example, role-playing is a wonderful means of escape, and for such players it can sometimes be bloody awful when the session ends and life returns to normal. But it can also help again absolute emphasis. It is no replacement for therapy. It can help players, however, come to terms with either feelings or confusion that they may have. For instance, I've ran, and I'm tempting fate here, because the last time we discussed Wraith the Oblivion in our episode...
No! No!
Yeah.
Don't bring it
okay.
up!
Okay, so forewarning now. But we're all recording. We're all separately recording this episode, so...
Yes, you know, and I'm recording a Skype call, so, I mean, it's all going to Dropbox, yeah, so hopefully...
This is where it all falls down. So, we spoke at length about Wraith the Oblivion on our first iteration of this episode, and, of course, that episode died a death, appropriately, due to either Windows or the Wraith Curse. Yeah, the jury is still out on who or what is responsible.
Does anybody want to explain the Wraith Curse? I'm not sure all of our listeners know,
so,
know about that.
So Rich Dansky, the erstwhile Wraith the Oblivion developer, is pretty convinced, as a generally skeptical man, that Wraith the Oblivion has a curse attached to it. And this all goes back to when Wraith was first being developed by White Wolf of Old, Mark Reinhagen at the helm, and there were all manner of disasters. I think there was a house fire, and then there was a flood, and then all the paperwork was lost, all kinds of things, all in the initial development of Wraith the Oblivion. And following that, almost every major book for Wraith, when it has been in the process of being written or arted or edited or developed or what have you, has had some major disaster occur around the writing team, the development team, or something. So we got to Wraith the Oblivion 20th anniversary. Everything seems to be going absolutely fine during the writing phase, and then Rich Dansky met all manner of ill fortune, and it can only be put down to the Wraith Curse at this point.
Yeah, as an anecdote, when I was about Earplay, we actually, and it's been announced, but we were working on what called the Orpheus Project, which is a Wraith, the Oblivion-based interactive audio drama. And so we got Rich to write on it. And first thing he said is like, you know, absolutely, you know, all looks good. I'm happy to be part of it. I should let you guys know the Wraith Curse is a thing. And I was like, ha, 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 I've heard about the Wraith Curse, but this is not a tabletop role-playing game. It'll be fine. Narrator, it was not fine. We had all sorts of manner of problems on that project. And the whole time, Rich was like, I told you. And I was like, I don't know, man. I mean, things happen. It's new technology, blah, blah, blah. And then this happens. So I posted to Facebook, it's like, Rich Dansky warned me about the Wraith Curse. He told me it was not a thing. I stand contrite. It clearly is a thing.
And then Rich, who's a fairly quiet person on Facebook for the most part, drifts into your thread like a ghost and sort of says, I warned you.
And then I'm the ghost of Wraith Pass.
All right. So bringing it back to Wraith.
Yeah. So Wraith the Oblivion is one of those pillar games, I guess, that has led to players having an awful lot of, catharsis, moments of realization, epiphanies, as it were. And I can say this firsthand, having run Wraith the Oblivion before several times and played it, there's, not every occasion, but I would say every other occasion, a player has needed to take a break from the game or has had to ask for the Chronicle to come to a conclusion, or has addressed the group after the game. And these have been different groups, mind you. And said, you know, dealing with some of the elements of this Chronicle has made me realize some fairly horrible things that I've done. Not me, the player. I'm perfect. But... I never have a moment of realization. I've been coasting along since the age of 3. But for instance, obviously Wraith deals quite strongly with grief. Mm-hmm. You are dead, after all. And in many games of Wraith, you deal with the act of dying. And then you deal with the fallout from that. Because while you may be dead, your loved ones are likely still alive. And you get to watch them, essentially, through a smoking mirror. But can't interact with them in any meaningful way. The realization of how the living have to go on after someone has passed away can really hit people hard. The mechanic of the harrowing, which exists within Wraith the Oblivion, where you are essentially dragged down to the lowest reaches of the underworld and have to experience something from your past, let's say in a Christmas Carol or It's a Wonderful Life kind of a way, you get to experience what life is like without you, what it would have been like without you ever existing, an element from your past that is making you feel regret or guilt, that kind of thing, but it's always dialed up to 11 because Wraith is still a horror game. Mm-hmm. Harrowings live up to their name. And right. I was running an online chronicle of it on my channel, on my YouTube channel, which is still on there. It's not many sessions long. And I'm mentioning Mark Reinhagen. He was one of the players in it. And a couple of very good friends took part as well. And we got to the first harrowing in the chronicle and played through it. And after the session, one of the players said, this has been fantastic, but I just can't go on with this. It is bringing up too many feelings. And we respected that because, after all, it's only a game. Friendships are more important. And this is something we'll likely get into in the idea of, I guess, warnings, guidelines, setting limits, right. Acknowledging when players are hurting. But Wraith has always been a game which it has an ability to touch a raw nerve with any number of players, because death is something everyone encounters at some point in their life. And so I was wondering, from the two of you, have you ever had games that have, I guess, brought these moments of realization or points of learning for players or yourselves?
I'll take a secret.
Sorry, it's like silence while I think about it.
Okay, well, I'll go ahead then. Yeah, I don't have the awkward silence song in this version. Oh, man.
Awkward silence time.
Skip it up. Da, 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 da. It's an awkward silence.
It's an awkward.
On the last session, we had a similar awkward silence, and Dixie sang the awkward silence song, and I threatened to use it in other episodes, and now I have another version I can use. one example I had of that, it was kind of more of the situation shifted, and that gave me a new context, is for a long time, I was heavily involved in the Camarilla fan club, now known as Mind's Eye Society, interconnected live action Vampire the Masquerade and World Darkness Chronicles. And so for a couple of years, I was playing a fairly notorious anarch. Me and my wife were the head of the gang that, over the course of a couple of years, became extremely powerful. There were a couple of times we were able to go into smaller cities and actually just kind of deposed princes because we didn't like them. So they were really, really aggressive, and a lot of people hated us, and that was fair. We were jerks. But part of the character arc we were exploring is the idea of becoming more hardcore, becoming more fanatical, becoming more aggressive, becoming more violent in our actions, because we felt that as we were moving up the chain, the camera was going to start clamping down on us hard, and we had to basically get our preemptive revenge, as it were. You know, we had to get licks in first before they got us. And so we were playing this way all the way through 2011, and then 9/11 happens. There was a lot of all hands on deck. We need to figure out how this happened. You know, consoling our friends. Games are kind of put on hold for a little bit. My wife was the national storyteller at the time, so she had to do a lot of this event occurred in our chronicle, but it was not done by any supernatural force. Horrible things just happen, and there's a lot of discussion and tension around that point. So it took a couple months before we got back into game, and we started playing. And after a couple of hours, my wife and I looked at each other, and I was just like, I don't think I can do this anymore, because it was too close to the ideology being spouted by Al Qaeda during that event. And so we went to the storytellers, like, you can write us out. We're happy to give you the NPCs. Have some elaborate death scene for them so people have a catharsis. And we talked to the other members of people playing our gang, and we're just like, we understand that you guys looked up to us, you had a lot riding on us, but I just can't do this anymore. I have too much empathy for people that I always found reprehensible, but now it's too close to the skin, and it's too much bleed happening for me. So and they all respectfully understood. A lot of people were feeling the same way, honestly, and they're glad that someone said something. But that was a case where it was an interesting catharsis and exploration of Aberyn's morality just became way too close to home and say, I can't do this anymore. So that was one point where it's like, I have to put the brakes on. I can't continue to explore this character concept.
Right. You know, I've been thinking, well, Paul, while you've been dogging, and I'm not sure I've ever been involved in a game that had one of those, like, major moments, but as a lot of our podcast listeners probably know, I haven't gamed as much as an adult as I would like to. Like, most, the bulk of my really hardcore, like, you know, vampire, mage, changeling years were from the ages of, like, 14 to 23, and I'm just not sure that we were, you know, coming at them with the maturity that we're talking about them today. So there was a lot more, you know, silly stuff and just being vampires that were, you know, murdering people and things, and probably
these so-called superheroes with fangs.
Yeah. And probably would have struck me a little harder as an adult. But also, one thing I noticed about myself is because I struggle with mental health stuff and because I have a history of bullying, I've looked at a lot of LARPs and games at conventions, and there are several that I just decided not to try because I didn't want to deal with that. There's a very popular LARP called New World Magiscola that's kind of a Harry Potter-esque, you know, but college-age thing. And I thought about playing it, and I talked to one of the people who was running it at the time and found out that there are people who play bullies. And I was like, I don't want that. I do not want to be bullied. I don't know how to get around it in the LARP context. And there are certain buttons that I still have that if somebody pushes them, I might cry. And like, I didn't want to put myself through that. And so sometimes I will look at some of these LARPs, and there are a ton of them out there now that are almost meant to be a little traumatic. And I'm like, I just don't know if I want to play that. That sounds like putting myself through something unnecessarily. So I'm not sure I have that same experience. I'd be interested to play an actual heavy, serious game at some point. But since most of my role-playing in the past few years has either been kind of short D&D campaigns or things like Pugmire and Mao, which were mostly just fun one-shots and things, or other one-shots. Like, I've done a Shadowrun one-shot, and I've done a bunch of other one-shots at various events. But, like, those are, like, one-shots don't really lend themselves to getting super deep.
But, well, one thing, because you touched on it here, and it's something you may even know, I think you probably know more than Eddie and I about, is on the subject of, let's say, I've similarly got very little interest in playing a game where I go back to school days because
they were terrible.
Yeah, and even as some kind of therapeutic exercise, again, I wouldn't attend a LARP for that. I would go to a therapist, but that takes us on to the idea of guidelines, warnings, putting things in place like the X card to prevent those, or at least help ameliorate the idea of suffering any kind of PTSD from a role-playing experience.
Right.
And I mean, that Wraith session I was talking about, those will run at a time when I have to hold my hands up and say I was woefully unaware, and I don't think anything like this had been really introduced at tabletop at that point, the idea of having the X card in play where you can hold this up and say, this content isn't for me.
That's pretty recent,
But Dixie, I know you know quite a lot about this, and it's through dabbling in these LARPs and also sheer sight of so many role-playing games of ours that deal with this kind of mature content. Maybe for the listeners, you can explain what these things are.
Yeah. Well, this is something that if we ever have Jack Willenbrook on, or Jax as a lot of us call her, I'd love to talk to her about some of this because she has done a lot with trauma rules, processing trauma, dealing with it in games, etc. A lot of her games are kind of focused on those things. I think she works through some of her stuff by, you know, writing these games that help process. She actually wrote the content rules, trauma rules, etc. for Vampire 5th Edition, which is cool. But yeah, I'm a big fan of the X card. I cannot remember the name of the game that first kind of introduced it and called it that. I should know, and I can't think of it. But the idea of the X card is really cool. It's just that each player at the table gets a card that has an X on it. It can be an index card. It can be a, you know, post-it note. It doesn't really matter. And at any time during the game, if something gets too heavy or too much, or you just don't want to deal with it anymore, or whatever, for any reason at all, you can hold it up and it immediately stops and goes in a different direction. I think it's important to encourage people that, like, sometimes you just have to walk away from the table. And yep. Sometimes you have to hold up the X card, and sometimes you don't know that something's going to hit you weird until it happens. And nobody should be punished for that. That's one of the big things. I think some people think, like, oh, you know, if you can't handle this, you're just too soft. You shouldn't be playing a game with horror in it. And it's like, no, that's not the case. I love horror movies and horror books, and there have still been bits in horror movies, as I talked about on a pop culture episode, where I'm like, I can't watch this right now. I have to look away. We've talked about Black Mirror a little bit, where for some people, you know, the first episode especially, it's like, oh, I can't watch this right now. And that's fine. Like, knowing your own limits is fine and should be encouraged. And even though I think it's really helpful, obviously, to talk about things, like, as a GM, storyteller, talk things out with your players a little bit beforehand, especially if you want to include some more horrific themes in your game, especially if you're going to touch on things like, you know, sexual violence, things like that, that could be a potential kind of trigger for anybody at the table. It's good to kind of bring that up ahead of time. Like, you know, there's a reason that movies have ratings. And there's a reason that some books, a lot of books, have kind of a content warning or something in the foreword that says, like, hey, these are some of the themes that we explore. This book can get really heavy, you know, etc. I think we were talking about that a little bit with Mage and Book of the Fallen. And
yeah,
because that book is really heavy. And we try to let people know right up front.
A lot of people have reported similar experiences with Changeling the Lost.
Yes.
Because there's definitely the idea of innocence lost in that game, and that's something that can come as quite shocking to a lot of players. It isn't just that initial moment of kidnap and escape either, although that can be a big moment for any role player.
Mm-hmm.
It's the increasing feeling of being like an outsider, completely detached from your original family, your original friends and lifestyle, and what you're going to do to pick up the pieces after this. So in some ways, games like Changeling and Promethean and Wraith, those three always stand out to my mind as games that can really give a body blow to you as you're playing in the feels, as they say. But I think that they're also fantastic experiences that if you can put the guidelines in place that you need to be able to play them and not necessarily enjoy them, but experience them, get something out of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly worth doing, but I don't know. Would you say, either of you, there are any games on our catalogue that you think are, I guess, that would hit you close to home, or that you would feel more inclined to put warnings in front of than another? Because obviously, you can do it with any game, but what games ring as, I suppose, the word is the most likely to touch that raw nerve in a player group?
I mean, obviously, we talked about some of the major ones. Wraith the Oblivion, certainly. There's literally mechanics for emotion. I mean, it's pretty kind of upfront about what it's trying to accomplish on some level. I think either of the vampire games had the potential for that. And I think that's a little more subtle. I know a number of people have come to me when I was the V20 line developer, come to me at conventions or over email or over social media and say things like, you know, Vampire helped me to come out to my parents. Vampire helped me to understand my addiction struggle. Because there's a lot of subtext happening in that game. I know I had my own moments with that when my family has had a long struggle with alcohol abuse and usually loses. I've lost three family members to alcohol abuse, and so when my one of my uncles died shortly afterwards, I went to a vampire game, and just a simple feeding scene, I was like, I can't do this, because the connection of some needing something to live was too strong in my head at that moment. Mm-hmm. I think that any game that struggles with what we kind of largely call quote unquote controversial content has the potential for that. Certain games, like ones I mentioned, are more upfront about it. And this is slightly different from inclusivity. Inclusivity is kind of a different bucket, because it's more of a, hey, more people can play. Whereas this is more, hey, we're going to explore topics that can be cathartic, but also can be frustrating and even triggering. So it really kind of depends situationally. The World Darkness games in general, mm-hmm. are like that. Chronicles, I think, if I'm right, Dixie, is the potential for that too.
That's the thing, is that you ask that question, like, which of our games, like, it entirely depends on who's running the game and what story they're telling.
That's very because true.
You could run a really heavy game of Pugmire, and you could run a really heavy game of Cavaliers of Mars. You could run a really heavy game of Scarlands if you wanted. Like, we have so many games that you don't look at them and think, like, oh, that game needs this. But if that's the story that the, you know, GM, storyteller, guide, etc. decides to tell, then that's got the potential. I mean, you could make a super heavy, really hard to play D&D 5e game, you know?
You are completely correct.
Yeah, so though I agree with you that those themes are a little bit more baked into games like maybe Wraith and Changeling the Lost, and Promethean. I also think you could have really, you know, lighter, more joyful versions of those, if that's the story you want to tell. So that's the cool thing about role-playing games, really, is that, you know, we hand you a toolbox, you know, I say, here's Changing the Lost, here's a bunch of rules, have fun, here's some suggestions, but you can do whatever you want with this. And if you want to run a game where, you know, everybody is in tears by the end of it because of their hedge escape, or because they saw their, you know, wife with their fetch, the person who has replaced them, who looks just like them, then that's something you can do. But if you just want to, you know, hang out with goblins and, you know, run around and use magic, you can kind of do that too. It's not really built for that, but you definitely could. I think any role-playing game has the potential for that. I mean, obviously there are a few that are constructed to be specifically, like, silly, or, you know, funny, and those may be a little bit less than others. But anything that has roots in, you know, just telling the stories of humans can be, or, you know, of people, whether they're human or not, can go that route.
I remember when I was in Seattle for an extended period. I played in a game of Changeling the Lost there because my hosts were kind enough to invite me along to their role-playing group. And it was my first experience of seeing players crying. I'd been role-playing for a few years by this point, and Changeling the Lost was a relatively new release, but it hit with an impact, I remember. And I remember because, you know, we all do a little bit of growing up every single day based on the experiences we have. And I remember thinking at the time, well, being absolutely confused. I had never seen anyone have that kind of emotional response from a role-playing game before.
Mm-hmm.
And it completely changed my mind about what role-playing games could do. Again, I guess going back to the title, the benefits you can get from it, there's that emotional catharsis. And people watch movies to make them cry. You know, not every single experience has got to be fun. I know that's something, Eddie, you're well-versed in.
Yeah. I'll just say real quick, because we did talk about this last one, I think it's good to mention, is that fun is not necessarily mean the same thing to other people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this weird case where it's the defining metric for the value of a game, but also is badly misunderstood and very idiosyncratic. So I do think we could do an entire episode on the concept of fun, but the kind of short version, since we're getting low on time, is I do recommend people pick up, if they're interested in this, Raph Koster's A Theory of Fun. It's been out for 10 years now, and it's still kind of the go-to work. And it's very simple, very accessible, lots of fun illustrations. But to talk a lot about how people parse fun and what fun really means from the concept of game design.
Right.
Well, if we're low on time, does that mean we should wind up now, Eddie?
I mean, you're the host. You do what you got to do. I have no control over you.
No, you do not. That's the thing. I was going to run right over you if you try to give me an order. I have one last. I've got one last question for you to the group, and it's regarding another kind of benefit one can get from role playing games. I gained an awful lot of historical interest from playing games like Dark Ages Vampire, Pendragon. To the point that I was going to travel to Jerusalem based on a fantastic chronicle of Dark Ages Vampire that I got to participate in. It so enlivened my interest about the Crusades that I was determined to go to Jerusalem and experience these places that I had read about and played in. And a bombing, sadly, scuppered that trip, and I have never had the opportunity to do it again. But much as video games, Age of Empires, Civilization can really pique an interest in global history, so have role-playing games for me. And I wondered what educational benefits the two of you could cite that you may have experienced or have witnessed from these RPGs of ours.
So as somebody who came into role-playing having already been a member of the Society for Creative Anachronism and doing a lot of historical reenactment stuff, I kind of came in with a bunch of history knowledge, but I did use that to inform my characters a lot. However, I will say that every time that I've edited a book, because I always check things for spelling if I'm not familiar with them, just to make sure, like, if it's a place name that I've never heard of, or an event that I was unaware of, like a historical event, I will go and I'll check them, you know, on Wikipedia or whatever. And I will tell you that the Wikipedia holes I have fallen into because of editing a book are many and varied. Like, my Google search history must look really strange, because it's like, I'll go from, you know, Googling some kind of gun or something to make sure that's spelled correctly, because I'm not a gun person, to Googling this, you know, location in Spain, to Googling a war that happened in South America in the 16th century. And I'm just like, I've learned so many little random things just from working on them. So I'm assuming that, you know, anybody that reads them will probably find these little historical things as well and take knowledge from that.
And for me, it's kind of similar. I kind of came in with historical interest. I was among the many reasons I was picked on, one of them was the fact that I voluntarily read Victorian literature.
Yes. Oh, same. Oh, gosh.
People are like, why are you reading a book that's 100 years old? And it's like, because it's not you. But it did kind of help reinforce and enhance that interest in history. But also cultural knowledge was really helpful. I did not have a ton of access to countries outside of my own for a long time. My mom was born and raised in England. Even though she was an American citizen, she ended up with dual citizenship. So she brought a lot of the things that she grew up with over, so she indoctrinated me, like a love of like Doctor Who and Masterpiece Theater.
Right.
My love for tea came from that. So I was always given a chance to explore things like my budding Anglophilia, as well as just learning about other cultures. And a lot of the books I would pick up for role-playing games were source books for other countries, and kind of comparing between them. So that, for me, a lot of cultural knowledge came from playing tabletop role-playing games.
Right.
As well.
Yeah, I can see that. My family is likewise very into all things British, or were when I was a kid. So I grew up watching Doctor Who with my aunt and drinking tea. And then at one point, when I was like maybe 12, they took the whole family over to, we did like a tour of England, Scotland, and Wales. Where, you know, there's a lot of tea drinking in pubs and walking around looking at cathedrals and things like that. So, right. You know, it wasn't as much my bag, but it was definitely something that influenced me growing up. And then, yeah, I tried to kind of segue that into other cultures too. So,
one side note is that sometimes I found out I was like horribly misinformed.
Yes.
Like, my family also comes from Irish stock, so I was also a mild Hibernophile. But actually moving to Ireland and realizing, oh, I had no idea what, you know, it's very different than what I thought it was going to be in a lot of ways.
Right.
Because of this kind of American perspective, and a lot of little bits of knowledge I had about Ireland came from Irish Americans, which is a very, very, very different thing than people who actually live in Ireland. So some of it was distorted, but it like you said with Matthew, it's like, you know, inspired me to travel in a lot of ways, to learn about these things a bit more, like you just did with all the travel you did as well.
Well, the good thing is, I love Britain as well. can't get enough of it. I love Europe too. I'm not one of those Brits, but and on that note, we will come to a happy close. And one thing I'd like you to do, Eddie, as well as telling people where they can find you online, is telling them where you can find the foundations that you have mentioned.
Absolutely. iThrive, the main place is their website, iThrive.org, and that is lowercase I, capital T, Thrive. And they have a lot of resources on their website. If you're a game designer in particular, you could download kits about how to increase empathy in your game, for example. And also they do a lot of game jams, of kindness jams and empathy jams, to kind of encourage both kids and adults to design in that sphere. The Bodhana Group also is, I believe, the bodhanagroup.org. Again, Bodhana Group. But also they have a strong Facebook presence, and you can find it there. And Save Against Fear is based off of the Bodhana Group website. And as for me, you can find me anywhere at Eddie Fate, EddieFate, EddieFate.com. Or if you want to look at my professional stuff, you can find me anywhere at Pugsteady.com.
And Dixie?
Yeah, so you can find me on social media at Dixie Cyanide, but also, as this is dropping this Friday, you can find me at HLGCon in Atlantic City. Yay. So I'll be at High Level Games Con all weekend. I will be on a couple of panels. I'm running Eddie's Developer Bootcamp, which is super fun. You know, if we get enough people. I hope we do. I don't know. We'll see. And I'm also DJing the Pandemonium LARP. So if you walk by the Pandemonium LARP, wherever that's happening, and you hear really loud 80s music, that's my fault.
And how many days of 80s music do you have?
Okay, so... Yeah, so I was going through all of my music, because I haven't DJed in a little bit. I did it a lot from when I was 18 to mid-20s, and I've done a few guest spots since then. It's not something that I do all the time anymore, but I am, like, a legit, I know how to DJ. And so I was afraid I had gotten rid of a lot of my music because I haven't done it in so long. And I opened up my DJ program and I imported my 80s music file. And I have, I think it was 4 days, 6 hours, and 35 minutes of music.
That's going to be a long party.
Well, yeah, I was concerned because I have to DJ for 8 hours because it's 2 4-hour events. And I was like, man, that's a long time. I don't know if I have enough music. And then I did that and I was like, oh, I could literally DJ the entirety of the convention.
Non-stop.
Yeah, like from when I get there on Thursday to when I leave Sunday afternoon, I could be playing 80 songs. Yeah.
Well, you can find me on Twitter as Clack Click Bang. You can find me on YouTube in the Onyx Path forum as The Gentleman Gamer, and I'm not DJing this coming weekend. I'll probably be doing something fun like sleeping, and
what?
That will be its own reward. And with that said, many thanks for listening. Many worlds, one Pathcast.
Awkward silence time.